true worth, and yet he could not shake his certainty about himself. This worried him. He worried that he was only an ornament, a shell without meat, a hollow clam. He worried that his own self-estimation was a vain one. He therefore apprenticed himself to the spiritual life. He quested after the wisdom of his ancestors, so as to teach himself to doubt himself. As a monk seeks to transcend the lesser functions of his body, so did Terao Tafare seek to transcend this lesser function of his will. But a man cannot master his will without the expression of it. Tafare could never strike a balance between surrendering to his impulses and fighting them. The iwi to which Tafare belonged was Pautiningai Tahu, a people who had once commanded the entire western coast of the South Island, from the steep-sided fjords in the south to the palms and stony beaches in the far north. 6 years ago, the Crown had purchased this extensive tract of land for a sum of £300, reserving for Pautiningai Tahu only the Arahura River, sections of its banks, and a small parcel of land at Mafera, the mouth of the River Grey. The negotiations had at the time struck Pautiningai Tahu as unfair. Now, 6 years later, they knew the purchase to be patent theft. The thousands and thousands of diggers who had since flocked to the coast in pursuit of gold had each purchased a prospector's license at £1 apiece, and land at a price of 10 shillings per acre. That profit alone was considerable, but that was to say nothing of the value of the gold itself, hidden in the rivers and mingled in the sands, whose aggregate value was so colossal it had not yet been given a figure. Every time he thought about the wealth his people ought to have commanded, Tafare felt a swell of anger in his chest, an anger so bitter and tormented that it manifested as pain. Thus it was to the Crown, and not to Pautiningai Tahu, that Crosby Wells had paid his £50 when he purchased 100 rolling acres at the eastern end of the Arahura Valley, an acreage that was thick with totara, a finely grained wood that answered well to a knife and did not weather under salt or storm. Wells was pleased with his purchase. His two great loves were hard work, and hard work's reward, whiskey when he could get it, and gin when he could not. He built himself a one-roomed cottage overlooking the river, cleared a space for a garden, and began to build a timber mill. Terao Tafare travelled up the Arahura Valley relatively frequently, for the reason that he was a hunter of Paunamu, and the Arahura River was filled with that treasure. Smooth, milky-grey stones that, when split, showed a glassy green interior, harder than steel. He was a competent carver, even, some said, an excellent one, but it was in sourcing the stone from the riverbed that he was truly and uniquely skilled. Paunamu was as dull and ordinary on the exterior as it was bright and iridescent within. Tafare, with his practiced eye, did not need to scratch or split the stones at the riverbank, but carried them back to Mafera untouched, so that they could be blessed and broken in the ceremonial way. The acreage purchased by Crosby Wells banked onto Pautiningai Tahu land, or as we should properly say, banked onto the portion of land to which Pautiningai Tahu had been so recently confined. In any event, it was not long before Terao Tafare encountered Crosby Wells. Having been attracted by the sound of Wells' axe ringing through the valley as he split kindling for his fire. Their acquaintance began cordially and became frequent. Over time, Tafare began to call in at Crosby Wells' cottage each time he was near. Wells, it turned out, was an enthusiastic pupil of Maori life and law, and so Tafare's visits became a tradition. Terao Tafare loved any chance to enlighten other men upon those qualities that best defined him, and never more than when his audience flattered those aspects of his person about which he cherished a deeply private doubt, namely his Maori, his spirit, his religion, and his depth. Crosby Wells, over the coming months, questioned Tafare relentlessly about his beliefs as a man and as a Maori man of Ngāi Tahu allegiance. He confessed that Tafare was the first non-European with whom he had ever spoken. His curiosity, so expressed, had all the qualities of thirst. Tafare, it must be said, did not learn a great deal about Crosby Wells during this time. The latter seldom spoke about his own past, and it was not Tafari's habit to ask a great many questions. He considered Crosby Wells a kindred spirit, however, and often told him so, for, like all fundamentally confident persons, Tafari was very happy to compare himself to others, intending all such comparisons as compliments of the most heartfelt kind. On the morning after Crosby Wells' death, Tafari arrived at his cottage with a gift of food, as was their custom. He supplied the meat, and Wells the spirits, an arrangement that satisfied both men. In the clear space before Wells' cottage, he met a cart departing. Holding the reins was the Hokitika physician, Dr. Gillies. Beside him sat the jailhouse chaplain, Carol Devlin. Tafari did not know either of these men, but when his gaze moved to the cart, he saw a familiar pair of boots, and beneath a folded blanket, a familiar form. Tafari gave a cry and dropped his gift upon the ground in shock. The chaplain, taking pity on him, suggested that he might accompany his friend's body back to Hokitika, where it was to be prepared for burial, and thereafter interred. There was no room for Tafari on the driver's seat, but, if he wished it, he could sit on the rear tongue of the cart, so long as he remembered to keep his feet out of the way. The hoteliers and shopkeepers stood in the doorways along Revel Street as the cart rattled into Hokitika and turned down the main road. Some trotted forward for a better view, peering up at Te Rau Tafari, who stared back, blank-faced, limp. One of his hands was loosely gripping Wells' ankle. The man's body rolled and juddered with each lurch of the cart. When they reached the police camp, Tafari did not move. He sat waiting, still holding Wells' ankle, while the other men conferred. The Hokitika cooper had agreed to knock together a pine coffin ready for the funeral, and to fashion a rounded wooden headstone on which he would paint Crosby Wells' name and the two dates that bounded his life. Nobody was sure of the actual year of his birth, but the year 1809 had been inked upon the flyleaf of his Bible. This was a plausible birth date, for it would place Crosby Wells at 57 years of age, and it was this date that the cooper would inscribe on the dead man's wooden headstone. Until these two orders were completed, however, and until the grave was dug, the jail's governor had directed Crosby Wells to be laid out on the floor of his private study at the police camp, with a muslin bedsheet between his body and the ground. When the body was arranged with his hands folded across his chest, the jailer ushered everyone from the room and pulled the door closed, causing the hallway to shiver. The interior walls of the jailer's house were made of patterned calico.